Ladies and gentlemen, we have really only a few classes left. I don't know exactly how many, four or five, to work on the story of Jacob. And I want to bring us up to date with where we are, because obviously we're not going to complete the story of Jacob in this semester, so to speak. We've gone through the sort of ambiguity of his birth, right? The two brothers, the realization that he is the first. On Sunday I spoke at the Holocaust Memorial, and we were talking about the fact that one day there'll be no eyewitnesses. All of us hear testimony from eyewitnesses. Jacob is the first one who didn't. That is, Abraham didn't give Jacob his faith. Jacob, in a sense, was the first one who has to hear it secondhand and still carry it on, right? He's removed from the founding generation, so to speak. And he also is the first it's clearly in contrast to Isaac, who's going to have to struggle to make his way and make his faith. It's not given to him. This is a characteristic that will be repeated by other Jewish leaders, in particular David. That is, Jacob is morally ambiguous in the way that he carries on the faith and what he gets from it. And there are two sides to Jacob. He is both a trickster, that is, he fools with Rebekah. Remember, he fools his blind old father into blessing him first. And then he goes off and has this dream of the angels and negotiates with them in order to gain whatever protection from God he can. He negotiates with God and says, if you take care of me and if you watch over me and if you bring me back safely, then you'll be my God. All this we've gone through at great length. But before we move on, which we're about to the second well annunciation scene, that is, just as Rivka was found at the well, so will Rachel be found at the well. It's a famous poem, and I happened to be reading, for other reasons, I was reading Yeats, and I thought that I would mention this poem, first of all because of its mention of a dream, and then for a second reason that I'll tell you. It's called He Wishes for the Cloths of Heaven. This is one of Yeats' early poems, and at the time he was passionately in love with Maud Gonne, who he never quite succeeded in persuading. I mean, she loved him, but not the way he wanted. Need I say more? Had I the heaven's embroidered cloths, enwrought with gold and silver light, the blue and the dim and the dark cloths of night and light and half-light, I'd spread the cloths under your feet. But I, being poor, have only my dreams. I've spread my dreams under your feet. Tread softly, because you tread on my dreams. Yeats used to read that poem to audiences and say, this is the way to lose a woman. Right? And then he would read another poem called The Cap and Bells and say, this is the way to win a woman. Right? Which actually I have here. And I'll read you. It's a little bit longer. But as long as you're curious, if you want to know Yeats' bag of tricks. I bring this up because the idea here is, as beautiful as it is, the reason that's the way to lose a woman is because he gave her complete power, right? I'm spreading my dreams under your feet. And I think that this was his analysis of why he didn't succeed with Maud. And I thought of Jacob because Jacob has dreams, but he doesn't submit himself except strategically to other people, right? Jacob retains his power, and we'll see in a minute that, interestingly, Jacob is also the first person in the Bible who is explicitly described as having fallen in love, right? This is, I don't know if you'll be able to follow this. It's hard to follow poetry when it's read. I'm only going to read it once, but I'll explain to you as we go along what he's saying. The jester, it's called The Cap and Bells. The jester, right, a jester wears a cap and bells. Right? In the court, that's how they make the king laugh. The jester walked in the garden. The garden had fallen still. He bade his soul rise upward and stand on her windowsill. So his first attempt is to give her his soul. It rose in a straight blue garment when owls began to call. It had grown wise-tongued by thinking of a quiet and light footfall, but the young queen would not listen. She rose in her pale nightgown, she drew in the heavy casement, those are the window shading, and pushed the latches down, so much for the soul. He bade his heart go to her when the owls called out no more. In a red and quivering garment, it sang to her through the door. It had grown sweet-tongued by dreaming of a flutter of flower-like hair, but she took up her fan from the table and waved it off on the air. The heart didn't work. I have cap and bells, he pondered. I'll send them to her and die. And when the morning whitened, he left them where she went by. She laid them on her bosom and in a cloud of her hair, and her red lips sang them a love song till stars grew out of the air. She opened her door and her window, and the heart and soul came through. To her right hand came the red one, to her left hand came the blue. They set up a noise like crickets, a chattering wise and sweet, and her hair was a folded flower and the quiet of love in her feet. Now, what do the cap and bells represent? His jokes, his levity, his banter. He started off, and this is Yeats's message, just like the other guy. He started off by giving her his soul and his heart, and she wasn't interested, but all of a sudden he enticed her with his personality, and then the soul and the heart could come in. So for those of you who know young men who are trying to win women, send them to Yeats. Yeats is your man. Okay, so when we left Jacob, who knew this instinctively, we come to, and you'll see this in a second, we come to chapter 29. Chapter 29 is where Jacob now is, he's had the dream, and he's going off to Laban. Now remember, Rebecca says to him, you're going to stay there yamim achadim. You're going to stay there for a few days, right? She doesn't assume, or at least she doesn't explicitly say that he's leaving forever. She's just sending him off till things cool down at home, right? Chapter 29, Jacob resumed his journey and came to the land of the Easterners, B'nai Kedem, right? Do you remember the last time Kedem played an important role in the Bible? It was a long time ago, right? Right, Eden, right? That's when they're exiled, they go east of Eden, right? As the title of the John Steinbeck novel has it. So already there's something about the East that suggests exile, right? That suggests leaving the perfection of home, which is what he's going to do, and it's the first hint that we have that going, well, not the first. I suppose we already know what Laban is like from Rebecca, but it's the first hint that we have that Jacob's life is not going to be easy there. Right. He's leaving a perfect place where his mother loved him, which is the sort of psychological definition of Eden, right? And he's going to have to win love. There before his eyes was a well in the open, Bas Sadeh. It actually is not in the open. What's a Sadeh? A field. And here, too, it's different from the previous scene at the well, which is an urban scene. That is remember, Abraham sends his servant Eliezer to find Isaac a wife. Right? So first of all, there's a contrast. Jacob's going on his own. Right? Isaac had a shaliach, had a representative go for him. Eliezer goes to the well, and there's this large, bustling urban scene with a lot of people running to and fro, but that's not true here. Jacob's life is going to be a pastoral life for most of it, and he's going to eventually, remember, make his fortune from Laban with sheep, which, just off topic, but it was kind of interesting. A couple of weeks ago, there was an article in the New York Times that they opened somewhere in the Midwest a sheep shearing school, and people were coming from all over the world because people don't know how to shear sheep anymore, and they've lost that skill, and it's apparently it's both difficult and important. To hold a sheep down, and so they have a sheep shearing school, which you can't say five times real fast, but a sheep shearing school in the Midwest. They should have it in Shropshire. Anyway, so there before his eyes was a well in the open. Three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for the flocks were watered from that well, and the stone on the mouth of the well was large. So first of all, the opening phrase here, Vayisa Yaakov Raglav, literally means Jacob lifted up his feet, which is a phrase that is found nowhere else in the Bible. Okay, and every time you find a unique phrase, you wonder what it means. So the commentators say that after that dream now, his journey was easier, right? He could lift up his feet. Before that, his feet dragged. But now that he knew that God was with him, he could lift up his feet, and he knew that what would happen would be ultimately beneficial. And in fact, the first thing he does is come upon these sheep. By the way, just to illustrate how difficult and rich it is to interpret the Torah, the other interpretation of he lifted up his feet is the exact opposite. Right? One is now his journey was easy because he knew God was with him. The other interpretation is he really didn't want to leave the place where he dreamed and God appeared to him, so it was difficult for him to go. So either it was easy or it was difficult, depending on who you want to believe. But one way or another, the stone on the mouth, on the well of the mouth was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the stone would be rolled from the mouth of the well, and the sheep watered, and the stone would be put back on the mouth of the well. Now, why is that? Why did they do that? Right, both reasons. One, so other people don't steal the water, and two, to keep impurities from falling into the well. Impurities can be animals, insects, whatever. I mean, you do the best you can, obviously. So that means that it has to be a large stone, and what is that? I don't know how to answer this question without making too obvious the answer. But what does it remind you of? That he slept on, right? Jacob somehow is related to the solidity of stones. Right? As Joseph is all about dreams, which are ephemeral, Jacob is all about stones, right? Remember, he builds an altar. He will build an altar when he returns, and he builds an altar when he leaves. And here he wins his love by being able to roll away the stone. And I suppose that stones represent endurance and solidity and immovability, all those things. But anyway, they're associated with Jacob in his journeys. Okay, yeah.
Would you suppose that the writers of the later Testament knew of stones when they talked about the stone when they confronting the cave of Jesus? There's a whole part of
remember that the people who wrote the New Testament were Jews, except for John, and they were all saturated in the Bible. Early Jewish, by and large, those who were literate Jews knew the Bible, I think it's fair to say, better than we know anything. Right? And I say that because whatever we know is also tempered by the fact that we know lots of other stuff, right? Any book you know, you also know lots of other books. Any television show, you know lots of other TV shows. Any family you know lots of other families. Our world is much, much wider. But when you live with the Bible day after day and year after year, it's impossible not to have those resonances. I mean, everything suggests something else. So, yeah, they absolutely did. And in fact, if you read the New Testament in Hebrew, it has all sorts of echoes of the Hebrew Bible. It's just that when you read it in English, you don't feel it as much. The scene at the well is, remember, the reason that you have these scenes at the well is because that's where everyone goes in the ancient world, right? It's the mall, basically, except that everyone not only wants to go there, but everyone has to go there. You could live your life without going to the mall. You can't live your life without going to the well. So if you want to know what's doing in a city, if you want to meet someone, you want to see someone, you head straight for the well, because inevitably, everybody will come there. He's looking for, and remember, she says to him, that is, his mother says to him explicitly, go find your family from Lavan and stay there for a while, okay? He does not go there, unlike Eliezer, he doesn't go there to find a wife, at least she doesn't say so. She does mention that you don't want to find, you know, the problem with Esau finding a wife around here, and she gives that as a reason to Isaac. I shouldn't say that, but she doesn't say it to him. Jacob said to them, my friends, where are you from? Achai, literally my brothers, but my brothers here is my friends. And they say, we're from Haran. And he says, "Do you know Lavan, the son of Nahor?" And they say, "We do." And he says, "Is he well?" And they say, "Yes, he is." And there's his daughter Rachel to the coming to the flock. So, first of all, the first thing to realize is that he doesn't know that he's arrived. He's where he's supposed to be, but he doesn't know it. And this echoes again when he wakes up from the dream. Remember, he says, "Achein yesh Adonai b'makom hazeh v'anuchi lo yadati." There's a God here and I didn't know. Jacob is, he's not only skilled, but remember, I think I mentioned it here, but if I didn't, remember the one question Napoleon used to ask about all his generals? Is he lucky? Right? Jacob is lucky, right? Which is even better than being skilled, right? He just, I mean, the first well he walks into, go figure, here comes Rachel, right? Lavan's daughter. That's really very lucky. And the people that he runs across, they remind me of Ish Dotan, when Joseph is looking for his brothers, right? We'll come to eventually. When he's looking for his brothers and he doesn't know where they are, he runs across this man from Dotan who just sort of appears out of nowhere, directs him in the right way, and then disappears. And there is this is the way I think that the Bible insinuates that God is directing the action. He just happens to come along and there are these people and they say, well, there's Rachel, who happens to be his daughter. And there also the commentators say some things about them because they're not going to like them later. So they talk about how they're very cryptic in their answers. You know, they're not friendly to him. They don't say, you know, who are you? Where are you from? They answer him basically in one word answers. Yeah.
And what's the reason for him asking, is he well? You know, as opposed to where can I find him?
Pleasant.
It could be, well, one of the two things that you say, either pleasantry or he wants, my guess is that he wants as much information before he goes into the, I think he says, is he well, to get more than just, yes, he's fine. They want to say, well, you know, his business is going well, or he had a reversal recently, he's not doing so well, or yeah, he's well with a family like that, who wouldn't be well? Yeah. Right. If he means well or he means badly, he might be saying, you know, I hope his family's, yeah, doing well. So I think all those things are, yeah.
Do we include that for Lavan's character? Because if they're so indifferent, maybe they really don't like Lavan. And he's like, oh no, there's another guy who knows this person who's not such a good guy either.
It could be. They're abrupt with him, so it may be that it's hinting that that's what Lavan is like. I don't know. I think that it may just be to contrast with what, to make you feel Jacob's strangeness. He's coming to a place where nobody knows him, nobody's friendly to him, nobody cares about him. I mean, think about it. You know, here's this guy who just had a dream where the creator of the universe came to him, but they don't care. So it could be all of these things. I can't tell you for sure. But you do get a sense. And again, the Bible almost never elaborates on these things. It's very cryptic. It's very brief. But you do get a sense of his moving through a strange society, and he needs a haven, right? And that's what he finds in the house of Lavan, although, you know. Okay, she says, yes, he is, and there's his daughter Rachel coming with the flock. He said, it's still broad daylight, too early to round up the animals, water the flock and take them to pasture. But they said, we cannot until all the flocks are rounded up. Then the stone is rolled off the mouth of the water and we water the sheep. Rolled off the mouth of the well and we water the sheep. So his assumption was that it was the time to water the flock and take them to pasture. They tell him no, that it's not true, that first you have to roll the stone off the mouth of the well. And this is important because that's how he's going to woo Rachel, or at least if that's what he's doing. And it's not clear that that's what he's doing. But also, does this remind you of any other scene? Moses, right. It's also presaging the scene with Moses. This is how Moses meets his wife. Remember, he fights off the other people so Zipporah can water her flock as well. And this is, my guess is that this is the only time that women came in contact with men in a way that they would need this kind of rescuing, right? Otherwise, you stay home, but you go out to water the flock, and if someone was going to harass you, it would be around the well. So if you're going to have the hero act heroically, the place to have him do it is by the well, where he makes sure that the heroine gets what she needs. So while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's flock, for she was a shepherdess. Now, the other, the consistent rule here of Jewish heroes is that they're shepherds. Jacob is a shepherd, David is a shepherd, Moses is a shepherd. And for obvious reasons, right? If you're going to pick a profession for a leader, shepherd is, you know, someone who takes care of, in fact, that's how, according to the Midrash, that's how Moses was chosen, right? He was chosen because this lamb ran away and he followed it for miles and he saw that it was thirsty. And when it drank from the stream that it found, he picked it up on his shoulders and brought it back to the flock. And when God saw that, he said, that's my leader, right? So that idea that being a shepherd proves your ability for leadership is not only indicated by the fact that they're shepherds, but also that Rachel is a shepherd, right? And so was Rivka, at least to some extent, although it's not specified that she was. It's specified here with Rachel. And when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his uncle Laban, and the flock of his uncle Laban, Jacob went and rolled the stone off the mouth of the well and watered the flock of his uncle Laban. Now, what strikes you about that sentence? Yes. I'm going to read it to you again. Imagine being Jacob, okay? Imagine being Jacob. And when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his uncle Laban, and the flock of his uncle Laban, Jacob went and rolled the stone off the mouth of the well, okay? Right, exactly. Normally you would think, okay, he saw Rachel, here's the daughter of the person that he's going to see, but he doesn't do that. And this is the Jacob we know. He doesn't only see, he sees, right? He sees her jewelry, basically. Yeah. I think that that's true, and you're absolutely right that he does. And it may be a strategy he thinks, right, when I see that these are Laban's sheep, I'll water them. But I think that there's also this indication that he's measuring the money that Laban has. And this is a luxury that that someone who's poor can't afford to forego. Right? If Laban is poor, and this may also be why he asks if he's well, right? And he doesn't get any indication about Laban's economic status. But if Laban's poor, he's in trouble because he now has nothing but the shirt on his back. But he saw an opportunity here as well as Rachel. Now, it isn't until later, until verse, I think, 17, that we find out that Rachel's beautiful. Why don't we find it out here? You would think that you would find out that Rachel is beautiful the first moment that Jacob notices her. Either she was veiled, or that's not what he was looking for. He was not looking for her beauty. He was looking for her wealth. That's what, and the beauty only became apparent gradually, right? But that's not, he has his eye on the main chance. I mean, don't forget, this is somebody who just, even with his mother's prompting, he risked his brother's wrath and his father's fury to steal the birthright. This is, the rabbis don't talk about Jacob as a man on the make exactly, but he clearly is. And the question that we have to ask ourselves in part is not just the ethical question, but also the realistic question, which is, you know, what do you want from somebody who's going to be a leader and who's going to make it through this very perilous world? You want somebody who knows how to make his way in the world. And strangely enough, the idea that he would fall in love with somebody just because she's beautiful is not actually, I think, romantically it might appeal to us, but if we want somebody who's going to lead a people and create a people, that's actually not what we want in him. We want him to look for more, you know, it's just like that dialogue that we had here a couple of weeks ago with the woman who wrote the article settling for Mr. Good Enough, right? When he said to the assembled women, he said, you know, you're finding a man to build a family. And the idea that you're going to find this perfect soulmate is a dangerous illusion, because no one will fulfill all your needs, and you actually have to think about what's this person going to be 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. And you know, to put it in reverse gender terms, remember the song from Gentlemen Prefer Blondes about diamonds are a girl's best friend, right? Because, and the whole song is about how, you know, he fades and he goes away and things, but diamonds are a girl's best friend, right? So if you haven't ever seen that, by the way, you should read Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. It's great, terrific. Tony Curtis and Marilyn Monroe sings that song. And Carol Channing made it famous on Broadway. But the idea is the same, which is this actually is solid substance. And as you'll see, you know, Jacob is flexible. He doesn't only marry Rachel. He also marries Leah, and he has kids with two other concubines. But he has the wealth to support them all. So someone had their hand up. Yeah. Yes.
The foundation is wrong, because we can look at two ways. Okay, maybe somebody is strong, somebody is there. Even just the fact that the Mashiach is supposed to come from the house of David with all these
right.
things. On the other hand, I wish that we just go somebody who cares, somebody who's more decent, somebody who's more honorable. So I don't know, is it reality that somebody has to be like that, or we are brainwashing ourselves that a leader has to be conniving and survival or...
I think any leader has to be shrewd, yes. Otherwise, they'll get crushed. Any leader has to be shrewd. I mean, even leaders who are highly idealistic. If you read about Lincoln during the Civil War, right, the way, for example, that he brought his rivals and the people who didn't like him into his cabinet, he didn't do that because he wanted people who disliked him close because he enjoyed their company. He eventually made them into friends, but he did it because he was shrewd, right? So any leader has to be. Now, there are leaders who are shrewd who are unsavory, and leaders who are shrewd who are, you know, who are also idealists. I mean, Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion was not, he was not, you know. Yes. Begin, right, not Begin, but Ben-Gurion. But Ben-Gurion was clearly, he was a very shrewd man. And had he not been, he never would have been able to establish a state. And when you are, you sometimes take morally ambiguous actions. The thing about Jacob is that it's clear from the story that he grows. And the model of growth seems to me is better than the model of he starts out perfect. So, also he does fall in love with Rachel. He clearly does. But when he first sees her, he's a young man who has nothing. So he wants something, you know? He wants to be able to make his way in this world, yeah. Yes. Right. That's the other thing. I mean, if you want to, you can interpret this as he saw his uncle's flock and he figured, if I'm going to ask my uncle to stay with him, I may as well show him that I'm a useful and a nice guy. Yes, you can interpret this idealistically if you want, and the rabbis do. And maybe it says something that I don't, but I don't so much. I think that the other thing to say is that human motivations are never pure. They're never purely bad, they're never purely calculating, they're never purely good, right? The only purely calculating figures are in fiction. But most people are a mixture of motives. So I'm sure it made him feel good to help this woman and to help Lavan, but at the same time he thought, you know, it will also help me.
He was practical, right.
He was, yes, task-oriented. Okay, yes.
He also, it looked like he's his mother's friend. She was the one
right.
who did all the camels and
yeah.
all this sort of thing.
Exactly. That's right. She remember that's exactly what Rebecca did. She watered the camels, and then she waters Eliezer's camels, and now Jacob is coming back. They are the camel waterers. but notice what he does right away, and this I don't actually know how to interpret. And there's every kind of... Then Jacob kissed Rachel and broke into tears. Now, The first thing I'll tell you is this is the, oh, here's a good trivia question. This is the only place in the Bible where a man kisses a woman who is not his mother or his wife. The only place, which is quite a remarkable thing, right?
And then he cries.
Now, a lot of guys cry in the Bible. There's a lot of weeping from men in the Bible, from the strongest people in the Bible. David weeps, everyone weeps. But he kisses her and then he weeps. So you can run the gamut on this. The rabbis all say it was a, you know, fraternal kiss. It was just a little peck on the cheek. Hi, I'm your cousin. Okay. It is, and notice she doesn't protest, right? She doesn't even say, excuse me, but who are you? But why does he do it? Is he overcome with emotion, which, by the way, would explain a lot about Jacob's character, if in fact he was one of those people who are just extremely emotional? And if so, by the way, it explains subsequent things too, right? When Joseph is killed, Jacob's grief is not just great, it's he wouldn't ever be comforted, right? He grieves unendingly for Joseph. And it may be that Jacob is of an artistic temperament, that he just, you know, he's the kind of person whose emotions are very out there. He's been traveling for a long time. He didn't know that he would ever see anyone from his family. He hoped he would see Laban, but for all he knows, he's going to get killed along the way. He clearly doesn't trust God's protection completely because he doesn't really know God yet. And all of a sudden, who does he come across? He comes across and he sees her, and he sees that she's well and that she's happy and that she has huge flocks and that his family is secure and he's going to be safe. And so he's overcome. That's a nice way of reading it, right? Maybe we should just leave it at that. Because it's you know, he has to be extraordinarily Machiavellian, very calculating, to actually calculate, now would be a good time to kiss her and break into tears. You know, you really have to be, yeah. Yes, it is a very, you can see the camera fading out. We'll come back. I almost missed this. This is good. Why does he say it's still broad daylight, too early to round up the animals, water the flock, and take them to pasture? I almost passed by that verse. And I don't remember who it is that points this out, but Sarna says it too. It says, quite likely, Jacob wants the shepherds out of the way so he can greet Rachel and converse with her alone. He's trying to get rid of them. Right? He says, it's a good time to go, you know. And they tell him, no, actually, we have to wait. But that's his intention. So Jacob is really very aware of what he's doing. And the reason, by the way, that Sarna says this, which is that, notice their reply. They say, we cannot until all the flocks are rounded up and the stone is rolled off the mountain. Well, and we'll water the sheep. Up till now, he says, they haven't said almost anything. Why are they all of a sudden become so talkative? Because he's basically accused them of dereliction of duty, right? He said, go water your sheep like you're supposed to. So he's touched a nerve, right? They say, we can't because of this and because of that. And in that dialogue is again, it's an indication of Jacob's attempt to set the scene the way he wants, but here it doesn't work.
He wants to send them away so he has the well to himself.
So he has the well to himself, and so he has
Rachel
to himself.
Maybe show off to her?
He does actually. He's just about to show off to her because he's going to move the stone. Yeah.
So I'm looking at this in connection to the phrase that he was a dweller in tents.
Right.
Would go around with the flocks, and he was basically a nomad. I mean, normally it's interpreted that he stayed at home, but this seems to be some indication that he's an experienced person. He hasn't just been sitting around
inside. Right. I think that's true. This is the nice return there to the nomadic, right, to the pastoral theme. So yes, it could very well be that by being a dweller in tents, it means that he's already been a shepherd, even before he comes to this, yeah.
Rashi says that he wept because he saw through God that she would not.
Right. Yeah, the rabbinic tradition is, because the weeping is so unaccountable, that it's a prophetic vision, he saw, you know, Rachel has two children and she dies in childbirth with the second child, with Benjamin. In fact, she wants to call him Ben-Oni, son of my sorrow, but Jacob changes her name to Binyamin, son of my strength, right, because she dies in childbirth. And the only place... This is ridiculous, bits of flotsam that stick to your brain. But the only place the Benoni that I know survives is, those of you who are chess players know that there's an opening called the Benoni. And that's where it comes from Benoni, because apparently somebody must have lost with it. But the rabbis assume, right, this prophetic vision. But if you accept, you know, makes his subsequent conduct problematic, because how could he know she was going to die in childbirth and still have a child with her? But these connections don't need to be made to make the poetic point that Rachel is going to have. Think of it as in terms of a movie, right? When he first meets the beautiful young woman and weeps and kisses her, the movie watcher might already think that something bad is going to happen. Right, there's going to be some kind of tragedy, and there is that presaging of. And notice her reaction, which I want to mention, for see if anybody agrees with at least what one of the commentators says. It says Jacob told Rachel. Now notice he tells her subsequently. Right, he's already kissed her and wept over her, and then he says, "Oh, by the way, just so you know who I am." He told her that he was her father's kinsman, that he was Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. All right, vataratz vateged lavia. Here, and then I'm just going to read. Well, he embraces and kisses him, takes him in the house. Someone suggests that that Rachel's actions are reminiscent of Esau's, that she also is hasty, whereas Jacob is careful. That immediately, right, she accepts him just on his word, and she runs and she brings him into the house and all of this. And maybe if that's true, that there's something reminiscent about Esau in Rachel, maybe that's part of the reason why he falls in love with her, right? Because she's part of what he is used to. Remember that Esau has Rebekah's blood in him as well, and this is family. And if it reminds him of family that way, so that's something close.
Yeah. He was a twin.
And twins, right, are particularly close to each other. Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
In a sense, it's almost like he's assuaging guilt over being the thief of the birthright.
By being close to Rachel.
Right. So that what maybe that's in part what the tears are about, that this, stolen blessing is now coming to fruition, and there's some guilt there.
It's an interesting question about what Jacob is feeling all this time, because he has a lot of time to think about what he did. And he clearly feels, years later, when Esau is coming with him, he has this great struggle with the angel beforehand, and he goes and he meets him. There's clearly baggage, psychological baggage, that Jacob carries with him about this. So, and also he's been, even though his mother may love him, he's been rejected by part of his family. He had to run away from home. He had to. So here's another place that's as close as he can get that takes him in. So maybe that's what the tears are about. Maybe the tears are about, finally relief. There's somewhere that he can go, because he's been running both from fear and from guilt. Here, again, the struggle is to think of biblical heroes as people, because as a person, as opposed to, Yaakov Avinu, as opposed to Jacob, our forefather, he has to have lots of different things going through him at the time. He doesn't yet know. And by the way, when he comes to the end of his life, unlike the other patriarchs, do you remember what he says when Pharaoh says to him, and we'll get to this, obviously, when we get to it, we'll talk about it in much more detail. When Pharaoh says to him, how old are you? He says, few and bitter have been the years of my life. Right? That's what Jacob says. And in fact, Jacob lived a long life, and he had many children, and he had many wives, right? And he, I mean, in some ways, his life was very successful. But in other ways, his life was a constant struggle, and it probably started off with that moment that may have been essential, but still was painful. So, yeah.
Adding on to the guilt relief theory.
Yes.
A relative in those days, this is how you greet your relative, you kiss her on both cheeks. And that's, you know, the way
that,
we do today.
Yes, it could very well be. It could very well be. I mean, when it says kiss, there's no reason to read into it anything erotic. I mean, it's fun to, but that doesn't mean that it's actually, right. It doesn't mean that it's actually true. So I would say that that's, in fact, here's the, for both Abraham and Isaac, you know, it says that they died in ripe old age. And here, well, actually, one more verse will help elaborate this. On hearing the news of his sister's son, Jacob, Laban ran to greet him, okay? Now, what news did he hear? We don't know. Hearing the news could just be that he exists. But remember, what happened the last time? What happened the last time Laban got news of that family? Eliezer came laden with gifts, right? So, yeah, what do you know? Here's another person coming from the Abraham family. Everybody, let's go take a look. He embraced him and kissed him and took him into his house. He told Laban all that had happened. Now, did he? Did he tell him everything?
No.
Did he tell him, and then I cheated my... The only thing that makes me think that he might have at least indicated to Laban that he did, bless you, steal the birthright is what Laván says. What does he say? You are truly my bone and flesh, right? That's what Laván says to him. It's too perfect. Right after he says everything that happens, Laván says, a kindred spirit I have here. Because that's what Laban is. He's also somebody who exploits the main chance and tries to take advantage of people. And who knows, maybe it is possible. It is possible. You know, and again, Miriam, you won't like this very much, but it is possible that, you know, over a few beers, Jacob goes, and guess what I did then, you know? My father, he can't see so well, and so I put some hair on, and it was actually your sister who told me to do it. Remember, it's Laván's sister, right? Who told me to do it, and let me tell you, and you can see Laván thinking, you know, that sister of mine, she always, when we were kids, you know, and... So it's possible that there was an actual bonding there because maybe Jacob was guilty for what he did, but a lot of times guilt comes out as bragging, right? It doesn't only come out as guilt. Sometimes it comes out as, you know, because if you can get someone else to affirm what you did was neat and good and so on, then you feel better about it. So who knows? Who knows? Yeah.
You said that Jacob did not taste, unlike Esau and... Right.
Well, that's an overflow of emotion, the crying, but kissing her might be the genuine way that you greet female relatives. I don't know. It depends whether you read that as calculation or not, and I'm not sure whether to read it as calculation. I just don't know. Yeah, maybe it is. Right. And also, I just want to say that people's guiding characteristics aren't the way they act all the time. They're just the way they act some of the time, right? We talk about people acting against character. The truth is that people have lots of characters in them, you know? That's Whitman's great line, Walt Whitman. He said, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. I am large and contain multitudes," right? We all contain multitudes.
Yeah. That what God promised them was not a ruse.
That could also be.
After all
Because he doesn't know that until now, right. He actually, I mean, it sounds strange to say he doesn't know God very well yet, but he really doesn't know God very well yet, just like Abraham didn't. So maybe...
He has that guilt at what he did, but after all, God...
Right, exactly. Because if you do something that you're guilty about and it doesn't work, then it's really terrible. But if it brings you the reward, then that's, you know, that's a tremendous relief. That at least I didn't cheat my father and my brother for nothing, if he cheated them. And I don't want to go back into that controversy, but yeah.
Do we know how old each of them are, Jacob and Rachel?
Well, it depends. If you really do the chronology, Jacob is something like 77. But,
yes.
I mean, if you really go back and you, I think it was 77. If you really go back and you, because you figure out when Joseph was sold and how old he was when he came to Egypt, then people work backwards. But this is, again, one of those cases where it's clear from the context more than from the chronology. Jacob is a young man. I'm guessing like 16, 17 in the ancient world. That's marriage age, right? So that's maybe even younger, maybe 15. But what?
Rachel,
13, 14, 12. Yeah, I mean, remember, Bat Mitzvah is a year younger according to Jewish law, not according to Sinai Temple, but according to Jewish law, because that's when women become fertile. I mean, that's when you become an adult. It's tied to fertility, so. It was 12 for women and 13 for men. And then the Talmud, which is, by the way, you know, the Talmud, which is a good, all right, 1,500 years after this, says that a man who isn't married by the time he's 18 is, you know, the next thing to a lost cause, right? You should be married by the time you're 18. So.
But isn't Esau already married with two wives?
Yes. So he's a twin. He's already got, right, he's got two wives and presumably many kids.
Relationship with Hashem that is not just the other story. He doesn't know yet. He's
right, but he hasn't seen a fulfillment of it till now. Right, he has a confirmation of it, but he wants to make sure that it comes to something. And here it comes to something.
And that's, yeah, to me, the whole, wow, I've come, it's the relief of a happy ending, which is
right, which you remember, and that's part of what we don't feel is the psychological tension building up in him before he finally sees Rachel, right? Because he, until that moment, he has no idea what the end of the story is going to be. Yeah.
Over here it says, that's me. Actually, translation means but. So it sounds like he's telling him a story that I'm here, I have no money, I have nothing. So after hearing the story, Laban thinks, well, he has no money, he has nothing, but you're my sister's son. Fine, I'll take care of you. I have no other choice.
It doesn't necessarily mean but in that. It can also, it's like a particle. It can mean but, it can mean emphasis. I'm trying to think of another example where ach means emphasis. Ach v'rak means, for example, only, right? It's only this. So you could read it that way. He could be saying Lavan, I mean, that puts Lavan in a nicer light. So you've got nothing, we don't care, you're still, what? Or a negative light, right, exactly. It could be either way, yes. But he could also just be saying, I don't care if you have nothing, you know, you're my sister's kid. And I don't want to deprive Lavan of all human feeling, right? This is his sister's son. So although, I just want to say, in terms of depriving Lavan of human feeling, look at the next verse. When he'd stayed with him a month's time, Lavan said to Jacob, just because you're my kinsman, should you serve me for nothing, tell me what shall your wages be? In other words, he's already been working for him for a month. Right? For a month he's already been working. As soon as he comes into the house, he starts working for him, and it isn't until a month later that Lavan finally says, okay, now it's time to negotiate. So, you know, I have a hard time thinking of Lavan as being in any way admirable, and his later conduct is not admirable, right? He tries to cheat him out of his wages, and then he goes after Rachel for the idols that she took from the house. Is he a terrible man? I don't think he's a terrible man. I think he's a little bit, I'm trying to think of what a good analogy is. you know, he's a sort of shystery, he doesn't want to hurt people, he wants to make a fast buck. And if it's exploiting his relatives, so he'll exploit his relatives, right? He's not, I don't think he's set up exactly as evil, he's set up as unsavory, just not, you know, not good, not a good guy. But it also illuminates what Rebecca came from, right? And why she was able to do what she was able to do, because she came from a family that knew how to fool people and how to trick people. And so she grew up with that, and she succeeded in doing it. Okay, yes, please. Yeah.
And Jacob was too pure, and he had to learn how to perceive people for what they really were, so the intent was him to be exposed to this.
So, right, Arami, yeah, could be someone who tricks also. If the only thing I would say, I don't know if Jacob is too pure, he's young still, and he probably feels a sense of loyalty to his relatives. But I do think that he gets an education in Laban's house, right? He gets a kind of education that he's suited to get. He already has those abilities, you know? But it definitely, it's an education for him. I have no doubt about that. And he comes through with flying colors, because he ends up, you know, he ends up getting what he deserves from Laban despite Laban's best efforts to prevent him from getting it. Okay, so yes. Eventually, but yeah, right. But that's going to be a long time, so. Well, the rabbis say that, but we don't actually know what he took. Right, exactly. And it doesn't, there's no indication that he has anything with him. It doesn't even say, if I remember correctly, it doesn't even say that his father gave him a pack, the way it says that Abraham gave Ishmael a pack to go into the wilderness. So I don't know. Presumably he took something. I'm sure Rebecca made sure that he had something with him. Yeah.
In fact, there's a funny commentary here that Laban's embrace was actually adding him down to
see. If he had gold teeth, actually, is what they say. If he was checking to him to see if he had any gold. And the reason that that was so is because of Laban's previous, right? That's why the rabbi said that's why he embraced him. And the kiss was to check for gold teeth, which is what the rabbis say about the Nahariyans in the Talmud. They say if you get kissed by a Nahariyan, check for gold teeth. They're checking for your gold teeth, and that's because Laban's previous track record shows that he's hungry for the goods, and so as soon as he runs out to see Jacob, they assume that he's running out to see what Jacob has. It does make sense, you know. It is in his character. And the gold teeth comment is, I always wonder, especially when we read the Bible like this, is there more intended humor in the Bible than we see because we read it so reverently? Because some of the scenes really could be funny if they were intended to be funny. But it's very hard to know if someone's trying to be funny if it's also, but Laban is kind of a comic character because he doesn't do any lasting damage in the end. Jacob comes out fine and Rachel comes out fine and he gets his wealth back, you know, so I don't know, but maybe he is. And maybe the rabbis are sort of picking up on that, you know. That's the other thing is I you don't know whether the rabbis are trying to be funny. And I'll close with this, I think I've mentioned it before, but they once asked Charles Lieberman, the great Talmud scholar, if there was any humor in the Talmud. And he said, yes. The phrase "scholars increase peace in the world," because you know he taught at a seminary, and he knew that nobody fights more bitterly among each other than academics. So he said the phrase "scholars increase" was clearly a joke. All right. Anyway, we'll see you next week.